When I was asked to give this presentation, and I saw it was on a Sunday morning, I guess I hesitated a bit. I informed Brother Russell that I'm not an ordained man, and I wondered if it would be appropriate for me to speak this morning. I don't know if you folks have a problem with a non-ordained man at the what some people call a sacred desk, but in our tradition, we don't have sacred desks ordinarily, so I hope it's all right. My topic is the Conservative Mennonite Church in 2003. First, it might be needful to define who are conservative Mennonites. The term conservative can be used in many different ways, as we've mentioned before. We certainly don't want to identify with conservative politics, although maybe we do have a bit in common with them, but I think we shouldn't confuse the world of politics with the world of the kingdom of God. Now, I interpret this in this context, conservative Mennonite, to mean what I call the conservative Mennonite movement in my book, An Introduction to Old Order and Conservative Mennonites. Now, that is the groups which withdrew from the Mennonite Church, the old Mennonite Church, beginning in the 1950s, and that movement has continued to the very present. It probably isn't altogether finished yet. These groups withdrew from the larger body in order to preserve what they saw as biblical beliefs and practices, including and maybe primarily the doctrine of nonconformity to the world, and especially in dress. And it would also include, of course, the head covering, the prohibition on divorce and remarriage, and the ban on television. There are other issues, many other issues, but those are some of the main ones that caused the movement out of the Mennonite Church beginning in the mid-20th century. Now, there are many other groups that might be termed conservative Mennonites that do not descend from that recent movement that I've just referred to. These come from a variety of different backgrounds, but are very similar in beliefs and practices. And representatives from quite a number of those groups are assembled here today, as I can observe. Now, these different groups of conservative Mennonites do get together on occasion, like at Faith Builders, the Conservative Mennonite Teachers Institute, and Christian Aid Ministries. I've been to the, what do they call it, the open house of Christian Aid Ministries, and I meet people from all over the country there, from dozens of different groups who do cooperate with each other for programs such as that and the others I mentioned. Now, these groups would include these other conservative Mennonites, or groups that are similar to the conservative Mennonites, would be the Beachy Amish, very similar. And then there are the Weaverland Conference Mennonites and related groups of what are technically Old Order Mennonites. I was talking with Weaverland Conference Mennonite not too long ago, and he wondered about a statement in my book that said that the Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Church is the largest group of conservative Mennonites. He thought the Weaverland Conference was larger. Well, it is larger. It's quite a bit larger. But like I said, the Weaverland Conference would be considered Old Order Mennonite because they didn't come out of that movement from 1950 to the present. They were a part of the movement out of the Old Mennonite Church, which was in the late 1800s, and then developed from that. Although today they're very similar to the conservative Mennonite movement, with some important differences. Then there are the Haldeman Mennonites. Would they be in the class of conservative Mennonites? Well, there certainly aren't many differences between Haldeman Mennonites and the conservative movement Mennonites in many ways. But the conservative Mennonites don't want to be identified with other Mennonites outside of the true Church of God in Christ. Also, it's difficult to classify a number of small Russian Mennonite groups, or what are often known as Kanadir, if I'm saying that right, groups that descend from people Russian Mennonites who settled in Manitoba in the 1870s. And there are quite a variety of those groups. I mentioned some of them yesterday, the Sommerfelder, the Kortitzer, Bergtaler. These larger groups have pretty much moved into the mainstream of Mennonites in the recent years, since the 1950s. But like the Mennonite Church, each of those groups have had a number of divisions. Many of the most conservative of those three groups moved to Mexico and later to Paraguay and Bolivia, some of those countries. Some of the conservative members stayed in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and they are apart from those main bodies of the Kanadir. And then very close to conservative Mennonites are another group that I mentioned, and that's the Kleine Gemeinde, and I talked to a man of that background yesterday. He might be here today, and he could tell you a lot more than I know. Les Lowen, if you're here. If you want to talk to him, you can get the inside story of the... And I don't think he would say Kleine Gemeinde, but something like Kleine Gemeinde. And the Kleine Gemeinde are very, very close to conservative Mennonites in many ways. Now, they were people who moved to Mexico in the 1940s, dividing from what became the Evangelical Mennonite Conference. But then the Kleine Gemeinde people started moving back to Canada. There is a church of that group, which Les, I believe, has been associated with in Manitoba. And then there's a recent church in Nova Scotia, and one in Oklahoma, and maybe some others that I'm not aware of. Maybe one in Texas. Now, one of the issues dividing the Russian Mennonites from other conservative Mennonites, the conservative Russian Mennonite groups, is the use of the continued use of the German language. That's still rather important in most cases. Although the standards of nonconformity to dress and lifestyle are different than those of Swiss German conservative Mennonites. Now, the same is true of branches of the old colony Mennonites who either stayed in Canada, didn't move to Mexico in the 1920s, or came back. They're not the same as the very traditional old colony Mennonites in Latin America. And in some ways, they would be somewhat like conservative Mennonites, although they have a lot of issues that conservative Mennonites wouldn't have, and I won't get into all that. And there are different levels of old colony Mennonites. I talked to an old colony Mennonite minister in Manitoba on the phone, and he referred to conservative Mennonites as white cap Mennonites. And there have been quite a few people of this Canadier background from the old colonies who have joined conservative Mennonite groups. I know of some, I think, pretty much entire churches in the Nationwide Mennonite Fellowship made up of these old colony or Canadier people. And that this would be true in Alberta and some other places. So there has been sort of an intermingling of those conservative Russian Mennonite groups and the Swiss German conservative Mennonites. Now, it's not my intention to make a group-by-group survey of the different conservative Mennonite groups in existence in 2003. That would take a long time, and it would get rather tedious. I did somewhat that with the modern Mennonite groups yesterday, but I'm going to take kind of a different approach today. I want to first talk about, or demonstrate really, some pictures, and I see if I understand how to work this. Maybe some of you remember seeing this in my book. It's a cartoon that appeared in one of the first issues of the Lifelines of the Southeastern Mennonite Conference. Probably maybe the first issue in 1973 when the publication came out. Now, at this point, the Southeastern Conference had separated from the Mennonite Church only 2 years before, and the conservative Mennonite movement had its beginning, very beginning, less than 20 years before that. Now, this artistic commentary demonstrates the perceived condition of the Mennonites of that era. And it's very much in the style of the cartoons of Ernest Gaiman that appeared in the Sword and Trumpet in the 1930s. I kind of like pictorial representations like this. As they say, a picture is worth a thousand words, because there are some words on here. But let's analyze this picture a bit. There are two pictures. This is the first one. This shows a badly damaged ocean liner rapidly taking in the water of the world. The streams pouring into the gaping hole include social actionism, misdirected education, political involvement, divorce, remarriage, worldliness, and something called Key 73 ecumenism. And I didn't find out exactly what that is. It would take a little more research into 1973 church publications, I suppose. Now, of course, the ship represents the Mennonite church at that time. It would be the Mennonite Church General Assembly was their official title. The group that would be now the Mennonite Church USA. Now, around the ship, the ocean liner, are four lifeboats and a number of struggling lone swimmers. Now, these, I'm sure, represent the various conservative groups and individuals who had recently withdrawn from the Mennonite Church. Then there are the comments of the people still on board the ship. I don't know, maybe those aren't too legible from where you're sitting, but I'll read what they're saying. The optimistic person on the lookout up here says, "All is well, full steam ahead." Another person hanging over the bow laments, "I'm sick of the whole thing, but I can't get off." Then there are a couple of skirted figures saying, "We're equal, let me steer." And, "Men can't speak on abortion." Right at the middle of the ship, a person is looking out at the lifeboats and swimmers and dolefully predicting they'll never make it. And close by, another person sadly comments, "We were just now learning to communicate." At the stern of the ship, way back here, a kneeling figure cries out, "Help, we're taking water." While another person stands over him and pleads, "Don't abandon the ship, we need you." At the very rear of the ship, a person cries out to the lifeboats and says, "Come back, we need you." And notice the different activities on the lifeboats, or of the lifeboats. The oarsmen in the one at the left here are rowing away from the ship for all they're worth. The three others linger close to the ship, picking up those who had individually jumped overboard. Now let's look at the next scene. I'm not sure if this appeared in the same issue or the next issue of the Lifelines in 1973. Or maybe it was sometime later. I didn't get the original source looked up. I suppose this is representing a further development of a somewhat later time. Now, notice there are 8 lifeboats and 8 swimmers. You can still see the stern of the ship, and the man posted there is still calling, "Come back, we need you." It's probably no coincidence that the ship is on the left side and the lifeboat's on the right, if you want to take that symbolism. The one boat is still rowing rapidly away from the others. Although if I were drawing the picture to keep the symbolism consistent, that boat would be going to the right instead of the left. Another boat is also speeding toward the horizon away from the others. 4 of the lifeboats are engaged in picking up survivors, while 1 is in tow behind the ship. Now, One can look at this picture and can try to figure out who these different boats represent. I'm sure the artist, and I just wonder who these artists were. The little initials show J-A-G-R-M-E and H-J-S. So I just wonder if maybe some of the artists are even present here today. It's quite possible. Now, I would have liked to have drawn a third picture showing the scene today. I do dabble in art a bit, but this would be a very complex, elaborate picture that would probably take a mural rather than a simple cartoon to demonstrate. And maybe a verbal description, and your imagination can paint a more vivid scene of what this would look like today on the ocean. Now, after 30 years, the seascape is quite different. This was done in 73, so we're 30 years later. And all we can see now of the ocean liner are the top of the lookout tower and maybe a bit of one of the smokestacks. A few people are clinging to these unsubmerged parts. Looking a bit closer, we can see that the ocean liner has been joined by another vessel. It's a submarine that has been tied to it totally below the surface. Some of the crew and passengers had been aboard the liner many years before this submarine, but had contended that there were many advantages to cruising beneath the surface of the water. Some of those on the liner objected to linking up with the submarine for various reasons and departed in lifeboats that were nearly filled with water from the beginning. And they moved only slightly to the east or right of the submarine and the foundered ship. Now, hidden from view in those first two pictures that, including this one, behind the ocean liner was another smaller cruise ship lashed to the larger vessel. Now, over the years, more and more of the ropes from the smaller ship to the larger one had been tied in place. But when the officers of the smaller ship recognized that the liner was sinking, they rather rapidly began cutting the ropes until now they are almost totally free of any connections. However, it appears that this cruise ship is riding rather low in the water. To the east, that is the right of the submarine and ship, are many more lifeboats than there were 30 years ago. Some of them are quite large, others very small. Now, to keep the image consistent with my little allegory, I might add that these boats on the sea are motorized. They're not rowboats, they have motors. At least one of the lifeboats found in the earlier pictures has been abandoned after gradually losing most of its crew to other boats and the last few people on board deciding to join one of the older, larger lifeboats. Some of the largest lifeboats are commanded by a highly organized staff of officers who insists that the crew follow very detailed regulations on uniforms and permissible shipboard activities. Several of these larger boats are they travel very closely together and communicate with each other and try to navigate the same course. They sponsor various training schools for sailors and produce charts and maps to set their course. Slightly to the west of this fleet, there are also a number of somewhat smaller boats traveling together. These boats are painted more brightly. The uniforms of the crew are more colorful, less austere, and the activities on board the boats are less restricted. There is some communication between these two fleets of boats, especially in sharing maps and charts. And in fact, those who produce the maps and charts get along quite well and sell each other's materials among the two fleets. There are also a number of small vessels on the sea that aren't connected to the two fleets, some of them traveling rather closely to the other two fleets, others taking a very independent course, and some travel sort of between the two fleets, relating to both of them. Now, the number of boats has increased from 30 years ago, partly from additional lifeboats launching out from the sinking liner, and the smaller cruise ship, and also from crew members on some of the larger lifeboats building their own vessels when they disagreed with the way their boat was run. There's also a lot of jumping from one boat to another by individual sailors. Not seen in the earlier picture are some other ships far to the west of the ocean liner. The largest of these is a very ancient looking wooden sailing ship. Several hundred years ago, the ancestors of the crew of this sailing ship had been on another sailing ship, but departed from it when the ideas of a young officer who wished to run a tighter ship were rejected by the senior officer. The young officer built this sailing craft along very simple lines. It's the one we're talking about now, that old ancient sailing vessel. The officers and crew of the larger, older ship eventually modernized their vessel, replacing the wooden hull with a sleek steel one, and the sails with diesel engines. Now, this is the very ocean liner that we were looking at in the first picture, and which is almost below the surface, as I said, linked with a submarine. The wooden ship does not have an admiral commanding the whole ship, but many captains who are in charge of various parts of the vessel. Some of these captains have very different ideas on how to run the ship, and there are often disputes creating other captains and separate crews, although still on the ship, basically. Some of the captains and crews insist that the ship is in bad need of repair. They very diligently try to plug the leaks in the ancient hull, put new caulking in the cracks, and mend the tattered sails. They try their best to pump out the water seeping in. Others contend that the leaks and cracks had always been a part of the ship and should be best left alone. They argue that a little water will not sink the ship. Besides, their children enjoy playing in the water before they take on the full responsibility of a crew member. And maybe this is what keeps them from abandoning the ship. At various times in history, some captains have departed from the old wooden sailing ship for various reasons. Over 100 years ago, a sizable group under several prominent captains built another more modern ship and eventually joined with the now sinking ocean liner. More recently, other captains with their crews left the wooden ship in smaller craft, mostly motorized. One of the earliest of these was that cruise ship we were talking about that had been lashed to the sinking ocean liner. There are also a number of smaller motorized vessels that have departed from the wooden ship. Some of these travel together, others take a separate course. The crew on these boats deemed it futile to try and repair the old ship. They even claimed that many of the captains were using the wrong maps and charts and would not land at the destination that all the boats were trying to head for. On the other hand, many of the captains and crew of the old ship judged that their real reason for abandoning the old vessel was their desire for the faster, more comfortable motorboats. Traveling to the east, these motorboats have come into contact with the two fleets of motorboats that I talked about earlier, cruising to the west of the sinking liner. Actually, this third fleet has a lot in common with the other two fleets, although the uniforms of the crew are somewhat different and their ideas of proper seamanship vary on some points. There are also several other old sailing ships on the sea, rather close to the large wooden vessel. These are not as ancient as the first one and not nearly as large, although some are considerably larger than most of the motorized boats. The crews of these sailing ships are descended from sailors who had been on the ocean liner, the ship it had replaced. Over a long period of time, several smaller boats departed from the larger ship in objection to various changes that the officers of the larger ship had made on the vessel and the way it was run and the course it was taking. These sailboats were very similar in appearance, but their design and rigging differed a bit from the wooden ship. Most of them sail rather closely together and assist each other in navigation. A few decades after the sailing craft had departed from the large ship, a number of the crew members on each of the sailboats expressed a desire to change to engine power. In the end, these seamen built their own motorized ships, one of which is considerably larger than all but a few of the boats in the other fleets. This boat is not quite like the other motorized boats in some respects. Outwardly, it appears more old-fashioned and is painted completely black. While it is powered by a modern engine, the masts and rigging are still in place as a matter of heritage. This large boat and two smaller ones have drawn closer and closer to the fleets of motorized boats that had departed from the sinking liner. Indeed, many of the crew from the black boat, and for that matter from the sailboats, have individually and in groups swam over to the boats in the two motorized fleets. Some of the sailors have become officers and even captains on the other boats. Then there are a couple of other boats cruising in and out among the vessels. They are engaged somewhat in rescuing drowning victims. Is that like the hook that they used to pull people off stage with? Then there are a couple of other boats cruising in and out among the other vessels. They are engaged in somewhat in rescuing drowning victims, I already said that. But their efforts seem to be mostly concentrated on trying to persuade the passengers of other boats to join their crew. They have a very convincing line concerning their superior seamanship and the quality of their vessels. They do not hesitate to point out the deteriorated condition of the other boats and the corruption of their officers and crews. The largest of these vessels proclaims that there should only be one ship on the sea, and that, of course, they alone have the qualifications necessary to be this ship. These claims are largely disregarded by those on the other boats. And some, especially those on the sailing ships, would see the raiders as pirates. There are many other watercraft on the sea, far too many to describe at this time. But before closing this little parable, I will yet mention some very small boats. These boats are not closely related to the others. Two of the boats are motorized, the other is a very small rowboat. They share many of the same characteristics with the other boats we've already talked about. The two motorboats move comfortably among many of the other different fleets of boats, and even occasionally relate to both sailing ships and for that matter, the ocean liner. These small boats are often confused with a larger boat that we haven't seen yet. The crew members look very much alike, but there are several differences in shipboard procedures. The one practice that they have in common, which separates them from the other boats and ships we have seen already, is their very different initiation ceremony for taking in new crew members. This initiation ceremony is shared by another assemblage of ships and boats in another part of the sea that we won't take time to describe. Getting back to the small boats, at first they appear very old-fashioned. The crew members, at least most of them, appear very much the same as those on the ancient wooden sailing ship that I've described. On closer examination, however, one will find that even though the ship looks very traditional outwardly, it has a state-of-the-art engine and makes use of the latest in nautical technology. So that ends my little parable. As Jesus said after he uttered the eight parables by the seaside, as he sat on a ship, "Have ye understood all these things?" Shortly after this, it's recorded in Matthew 14:22, "And straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and to go before him unto the other side." Whatever ship we are on, did Jesus enlist us on the crew? Are we on the right course to the other side? And when the storms of life rage and our ship is tossed by contrary winds, we must remember to look to Jesus walking on the water, who says to us, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Be not afraid."
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.